It's the Wonky Show. It's a big week for numbers as HESA and UCAS fill us in on size and shape. We'll get across all that. We're also thinking about assessment, the plight of third-year undergrads, QAA research on blended learning, and Dame Shirley Pierce gives Debbie the lowdown on the TEF. It's all coming up.
No, but I think it's interesting because sometimes when you see ministers or even people in the sector lord over hitting these targets earlier, it's not easy to, see behind, well, it is easy to see behind the blinds a little bit and see that the infrastructure is not there to support all of these students.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and ambushed by a cake for our work meeting, as usual, three fabulous guests. In South East London, Hilary Gebiabebeo is NUS Vice President for Higher Education. Hilary, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, it's so good to be back on the podcast. I was literally going to say ambushed by cake. You've taken it from me, Jim. I have no other highlight than I don't know what to say.
Yeah, that was quite a moment. Quite a moment, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And just outside of Tamworth, Laurie Phipps is Senior Research Lead at JISC. Laurie, your highlight of the week, please.
I literally had a line where I was going to say, walking into the kitchen and being ambushed by cake by my wife. And again...
Pressure's on, Debbie.
Yeah, but I was speaking yesterday to somebody outside of the UK, and that relates to the data I'm talking about later, about traveller participation in higher education in Ireland, and I was trying to find the data for the UK. So talking to him about what's going on in Ireland about traveller participation has been my highlight of the week. Tom Farrelly.
Stuff. Maybe more on that later. And in Enfield, Debbie McVitie is Wonky's editor. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, as Wonky colleagues will know, my three-year-old's been getting me up extraordinarily early in the morning recently, but this week he got a little cold, so he slept in until 7 o'clock. So wins all round, and I think you'll see that reflected in the quality of writing on the site.
Well, there you go. So yes, we start this week with numbers. Number Wang, HESA and UCAS have dumped a bunch of data on us. Laurie, what does it tell us?
Well, it tells me that I need to speak to David Kernahan more often because he's my go-to person whenever it comes to anything to do with data. But the things that really interested me is, I mean, there's been slight increases in student participation, but I was looking at the 50% drop in students from the EU and also the increase in students participating in that have got free school meals. That's gone up to a record high. So those are the sorts of things that that really interested me from the data. And it's only been released this week, so we're still sort of unpicking what it all means. And so I'm going to be really honest and say most of this, I'll be watching what David Kernahan says about it over the coming weeks on the Wonk HE site because, you know, I need a good source that can interpret it for me. So that's my sort of take on it. I would say that participation is something that I'm really, really concerned about. And as I said in my intro, I've been speaking to Tom Farrelly at MTU in Ireland, and they're doing loads of work around traveller participation. And so I tried to look at the data for traveller participation in the UK, and it's so small as to be insignificant. It's something like 3-4% of travellers actually go on to higher education. So I was trying to pull apart this data and find out, where those areas are and what the problems are and what the barriers to participation are in the UK.
It's interesting this, Debbie, isn't it? Because when we get a lot of data like this, it takes a couple of days for the kind of narratives to emerge in terms of the kind of, the big, what's really going on here in the sector. And of course, there's a backdrop to this year's set of narratives in the form of a giant global pandemic.
Well, and I think also a lot of people have quite a lot of skin in the game of kind of owning different kinds of narratives, so you'll see kind of that sector level data about, the record increase in participation among less advantaged groups, which of course is a win. But as DK shown on the site this morning, there's, it's actually a lot more interesting to dive into the kind of subject patterns, provider patterns, see which institutions those students are going to. And one of the things that DK sort of sounded the alarm on, although it's not perhaps as kind of obvious as you might suggest that, as you might think that higher achieving middle class students are going to the most selective providers and sort of seeing the widening of what used to be the binary divide. It's not that straightforward. There's certainly different patterns going on, but there's still that quite strong trend. And DK's point is that, just because we have expanded higher education, which is of course, a good thing in the round, we still need to pay attention to the patterns of participation within that.
Hillary, one of the things that both Nadeem Zahawi and Michelle Donnellan were popping corks over on the Twitter was the hitting of the international education strategy target on the number of international students 10 years early, which is quite a feat. And, you know, at the risk of being, you know, Mr. Misery on Twitter, I said, are we sure that we can, like, you do have to put in interesting types of kind of support, don't you, to make sure that you can cope with, you know, students for whom English is not their first language necessarily. You know, and actually, these are more international, you know, more, you know, less European and more international than perhaps we've had in the past. Is that rapid, sudden increase in international students great, or should we be concerned?
Yeah, I mean, to know, actually, I have seen that you've been trying to be less misery guts on Twitter. So fully appreciate that. No, but I think it's interesting because sometimes when you see ministers or even people in the sector lord over hitting these targets earlier, it's not easy to, you know, see behind. Well, it is easy to see behind the blinds a little bit and see that the infrastructure is not there to support all of these students. Often these students come into university campuses really, really lost. Like, you know, we haven't necessarily had the traditional inductions over the pandemic. We haven't necessarily seen international students get the comprehensive support that they have been needing for years and years. And so when we're celebrating that we've hit targets 10 years early, we're still, 10 years behind in actually supporting international students to really be able to, you know, to be a part of UK higher education, but to actually be supported through it. And we see this in how many international students talked about poor mental health, talked about issues with finances in the pandemic and before. And so I think it's very sort of, first of all, preemptive, but also I don't know what the word is. It's quite misleading, actually, that, you know, you'd celebrate this target, but not actually acknowledge the support that is needed so desperately for international students.
Yeah, interesting. We don't really have the kind of ways of monitoring. Laurie, on the kind of domestic front, are there any kind of narratives here about, you know, who's done well, who hasn't, you know, what's going on with widening access? Are there any kind of clear stories from the data yet?
So just looking at it, I was looking at the free school meals one, and that's an increase. But then, of course, we've got a whole load of people that have been furloughed during the pandemic. And obviously, there's going to be an increase in support to poorer families during the pandemic as well. So that could account for the increase. I'm not sure that a lot of people will be wanting, well, a lot of people that are in poverty are going to be worried about incurring more debt going to university, I think, during the pandemic, because it's now become such a hot topic being in that situation that it might be putting people off. I don't know. And so, as I say, it's a case of unpicking that data now. And it's also the fact that this is a really weird 2 years that we've been through. And I'm more interested in a longer term trend of widening participation. You know, we're at 43%, and I really would, I mean, I've always wanted us to be a lot higher than that. I'm just one of those people that really believe in widening participation. Why don't we have a higher target?
Yeah. Debbie, you know, this is a demand led system, and, you know, what we're seeing here is quite a bit of kind of demand in the system, and lots of, you know, kind of patterns of demand. But lots of people I talk to in the sector are worried then about kind of putting long-term bets on expenditure on, if you like, supply, because they don't know how the post-auger review settlement's going to come out and so on. We're trapped, aren't we, in a kind of funding settlement that it's very, very temporary at the moment, but demand patterns that are doing what we thought they would do. They are growing, and they will continue to grow through the decade.
I think when you're looking at kind of demand versus supply, you're talking about a number of different things. You're talking about the sorts of students that come with the sorts of tariffs that they have, and the sorts of courses that they want to study, the sorts of and the sorts of subjects they want to study as well, and then, you know, what they may go on to do afterwards. And I think that's always something that is very hard for a government to really meaningfully map out. I think, I mean, something that jumped out at me was and this may just be that, you know, we need to look at, you know, Laurie's point about longer term trends and think about how things trickle through the system. But if you look at patterns of subject demand, and DK's done some modelling on the site, and you, the numbers of subject applications and acceptances, you can see that, you know, some subjects are really kind of beginning to tail off and have been kind of doing so for 10 years. And some subjects are sort of continuing to hold strong and kind of, and sort of mapping existing demand. And of course, lots of subjects are sort of bigger than other subjects. The government has sort of said, oh, we're going to put extra funding into some subjects and remove it from others. and kind of try and put incentives in place to get students to choose one thing or another. I think really the question comes down to, will the high cost subjects be able to, you know, will it be kind of pragmatically and economically possible for universities to continue to deliver high cost subjects were there to be an auger response that cut the headline fee without any kind of supplementary public funding into those subjects? I don't think the government wants to do that, to be honest, because those very high cost subjects are the ones that the government deems strategically important, et cetera, et cetera. So I suspect that won't happen. I think there's a worry about cutting off kind of tariff entry, minimum thresholds for tariff entry, and the kind of interplay of that with sort of student outcomes and so on. But actually, I also think that a lot of the kind of action in this space will be not in the bit where no one's looking, which will be on the kind of the shorter courses, the part-time provision, the topping up of the skills and lifelong learning. And that's where I think lots of universities would really love to get clarity from government, because they're really poised to kind of do some quite interesting stuff in their regions and really kind of want to make sure that the kind of support and funding will be there. And I think in that sense, you know, universities are basically aligned with government. It's just whether the government can kind of, you know, get its arse into gear and kind of set out exactly what universities can expect in terms of support.
Now, Hilary, there's another tail in the data here, which is grade inflation. So, just before the pandemic, there was a sense that OFS wandering around with its sabre, having a rattle, was kind of slowing it at least. And then suddenly, in year one of the pandemic, no detriment policy, safety nets, you know, a lot of grade inflation. And the assumption is, well, you know, lots of people were given extra temps. Of course, there's going to be a bit of grade inflation. And the OFS this week has put a press note out saying, well, we're very worried that this grade inflation has now been baked into the system. And I was reading it thinking, yes, but it's not as if the pandemic stopped in May 2020, is it? Like, we have still had lots of disruption, and we have been making it more straightforward for people to have extra attempts and so on. I mean, what's your take? Should we get rid of all those structural mitigations because we're now back to normal? Or do we still need to be correcting for the kind of disruption that students have had?
Yeah, so I think it's a few things, right? I think it's, first of all, I sometimes feel like when we hear the narratives around grade inflation, sometimes people talk about it as if it's this sort of big, ugly, bad thing that students are doing better in their degrees. Like they see it as this sort of like big bad thing. How do we stop students getting better grades and therefore like going off into the world with these great grades and that meaning that it loses value or whatever? And it's like, no, first of all, students are doing better because there's better teaching, there's, you know, better access to resources that allows them to learn in newer and different ways. And so sometimes I think whenever I hear grade inflation, I'm like, goodness me, like, we constantly talk about a great UK higher education system, but we don't want students to get great grades because apparently that's a bad thing. But putting that to the side, I feel like you're exactly right. It's one of those things where, you know, students have not only been through a pandemic, now in the past few months they've gone through all the disruption that comes around with industrial action, which I'm not necessarily opposed to industrial action at all, but that's happened as a result of many other things going on in the sector. And for there not to be an awareness that students have been disrupted a lot and still are being disrupted by the pandemic, and there are other things going on in the sector, like staff not getting pay, like not fair pensions and stuff like that, it's just preposterous that we would think that, you know, these mitigations that were put in that were really helpful to students, we saw the impact on attainment gaps in some area, or awarding gaps in some areas rather, we saw how much students were, you know, less stressed about assessments in the ways that they are traditionally, because those mitigations actually were needed beyond the pandemic, and bringing them in the pandemic was necessary and important and continues to be necessary. But we can't just think that the sector is ever going to go back to whatever normal people are trying to get back to move away from those really, really important mitigations for students.
Well, fascinating stuff. As ever, DK has a whole bunch of charts that you can play with on the site. Take a look. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, it's Emily Dixon here calling in from Access HE, the division of London Higher. In my comment piece, even if BTECs disappear, the students taking them won't. What I wanted to say was that it would be wishful thinking to imagine that replacing BTECs with T-levels would solve all the problems BTEC holding students face in one fell swoop. We know from a lot of recent research that I go over in the article that BTEC holding students face worrying continuation and progression gaps in higher education. But we can't assume that new restructured practical-based qualifications will wipe these gaps out. We also have to remember that these gaps for BTEC students are still worth solving, even if T-levels replace BTECs, because these students still exist. We mustn't let the names of the qualifications loom larger in our heads than the difficulties these students face in our universities when we try to solve these problems.
Now, meanwhile, back in 2021, we set about talking to people about assessment. What was this all about, Debbie?
As with so many things, it's probably fair to say the pandemic accelerated changes that were already happening. And I mean, this is something that we'd spotted when in talking to people and the sorts of kind of conversations that were emerging from the sector, was that there was this focus on assessment. Some of this was about what Hillary was talking about no detriment policies and mitigations and what the impact was on grades. And some of this was because people had already been looking at, the decades and decades worth of assessment research that suggests that really, timed in-person exams is maybe one sort of legitimate way to assess in some circumstances, but perhaps wasn't kind of meeting the needs across the piece of all the different kind of courses and subjects and skills and opportunities to kind of learn things that students might enjoy. So we decided just to spend a bit of time as part of our ongoing work with Adobe, looking at the kind of how curriculum is changing and what that looks like in the digital age. Just diving in a little bit to how universities are thinking about assessment change, what's driving that, what the kind of positive consequences are. But specifically, given just how difficult assessment is to change, because it's this incredibly totemic thing, it's got lots of kind of issues around kind of standards and expectations. Lots of assessments are kind of set by external organisations, or there's very strong kind of codes that you have to apply to, and of course it's sort of very culturally kind of totemic inside universities as well, and it's quite a high risk thing to change. So we were looking both at what sorts of changes are coming, what people are thinking about, but also how they're kind of driving that change on their campuses and how you actually do that in practice. There's a big write-up on the site this week, but I would say there's sort of two things. One is that the kind of diversity of things that universities are trying to do is really interesting. So, the diversification of types of assessments, so trying to move away from exams and essays into students producing podcasts or videos or, doing sort of projects. There's lots of different ways you can assess students. And there's some really kind of good work on this that came out during the pandemic, particularly when it became impossible to do the kind of classic exam format. But there's also loads of interesting stuff about student wellbeing, how do you move away from this idea that by assessing students, you're sort of essentially putting them under the microscope and asking them to perform a certain way? And what are the impacts then on their wellbeing and their sense of themselves and their engagement with learning? Thinking about assessment for employability, mobilising more authentic assessment, and looking at programme level assessment as well. So rather than assessing module by module, every little detail, trying to look across the whole programme and say, what are students learning across all of this, and how can they kind of package up that knowledge and present it back in a way that allows us to kind of look across the piece and helps them kind of stitch it all together. So that's all really positive stuff. And in terms of actually driving the change, we sort of learned it's a long and detailed process. It does take, the kind of classic whole institution approach for senior leadership. But a lot of it just comes down to having really positive conversations in the disciplines, looking at that kind of route to change, bringing people together so that it feels less high risk, not just expecting individual academics to get on with it, and kind of removing barriers as much as possible, changing those policies, rewriting the quality, the quality systems if that's what's required, and just taking the time to let that happen in its own time. And I realise that can be quite challenging post-pandemic, trying to kind of get everything, trying to really lock down that learning, but people are tired and people need that time to really think about it. So we've set all that out, and I commend it to our listeners.
Laurie, obviously one of the things that was accelerated quite specifically is the kind of move online of assessment. And, for obvious reasons, I guess we weren't allowed to be in rooms with each other. And it feels like that's an aspect where we're definitely not going back, because there's not a lot of advantages to being in another room with someone taking an exam unless you really want to watch other people cry. But it generates all sorts of issues around identity theft and cheating and so on, doesn't it? These are things that people have got to think about.
Yes, they do. And we see an awful lot of rhetoric around students cheating. I kind of think, well, actually, during the pandemic, one of the things that we saw is this diversification of assessment. And when I've been interviewing students throughout the pandemic about their experience. And when it comes to assessment, they say things like, oh, instead of having a sit-down exam, I had to go off and do this work, and they gave me 24 or 48 hours. And it was really hard because I couldn't just go and look up the answers. So it speaks to assessment design. Rather than having, you know, things that catch people cheating, we need to rethink assessment. And that speaks to what Debbie was talking about. This isn't about having things in place to cheat. It's about having things in place that assess the right things, having things in place that enable students to demonstrate the learning. Kay Samble's got this great quote. She says, if the only worth of doing an assessment is to get marks, you need to rethink it. And I think that's really profound when you think about what we assess and how we assess in higher education. We haven't changed it in hundreds of years, sitting people down with closed books and saying, do the assessment. Well, what happens if you assess students? Dave Cormier in Canada says that what does education look like in a world of information abundance? So basically, students have got access to all of this information, and then we isolate them to do assessment. Why do we isolate them? Why don't we change the assessment?
Yes, a kind of version of that debate they must have been having in the 70s, because, you know, I was only born then, about calculators, right? You know, you go from assessing someone without a calculator in their hand to how they use the calculator, I guess. It's interesting stuff.
But that does speak again to the point that I was making with the widening participation. In the 70s, I didn't have a calculator, but some of the people in my class did. So what's the equivalent of that now? You know, we've got kids in schools and, you know, and students in education who don't have access to broadband, who don't have access, you know, they're in data poverty. They do not have access to all of the things that some kids do have. And I worry about creating, you know, with digital, are we creating new barriers that we just aren't seeing yet? I think during the pandemic, one of the most interesting things in some of the universities I've been working with, and I've got a chair at Keele, so I've been working with Keele quite closely. We saw the attainment gap close, you know, and we saw the international student attainment gap close. So what was happening there? And that's about assessment. And it's not
grade
just
inflation.
About,
that's what was happening there.
Well, and that's the other rhetoric, grade inflation. But even, I mean, Exeter University did work on the no detriment policies and said it didn't have that much impact, you know, when you actually allow for that. And this wasn't a coming together of those grades. It was a leveling up, to use that phrase. It was a leveling up of BAME students, of international students, of disabled students. So we need to look at what we were doing. One student with ADHD turned around to me and said, I've really enjoyed doing the exams this year, because sometimes when I sat in a hall to do an exam, I look out the window at something and then I look back and 20 minutes has gone.
Fascinating. Hilary, let me ask you a slightly different question. I was talking to someone last week, and I was saying, look, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, got to worry about a very anxious student body, and are there things that we can do so that students are less anxious? And they effectively said to me, well, never did me any harm, and, you know, assessment basically involves stress, so tough. Where do you sit on that continuum between putting students under pressure and making it really kind of, you know, stress-free and straightforward?
I mean, I don't think it makes much sense. A lot of the time when I've asked people in the sector about why they still think that, you know, putting students in a lecture theatre under these, like, quite intense time constraints is a helpful thing for them to do, they cite things like, it's good for the workplace, or it's good for their future careers and stuff like that. And, I'm probably in one of the most sort of intense jobs in the sector, where I'm just sort of constantly trying to juggle all of these things going on. And it's like, I've never had to, you know, in an hour and really like try and display a month's worth or a year's worth of knowledge that I've sort of learned.
You want to come and work here?
but this is the point, though. It's like, I don't have a normal job. The stuff that you do at Wonky to react so quickly isn't necessarily normal mainstream things that happen.
I mean, it definitely is not normal. No.
Yeah, and so when you're putting the mass student population under that and expecting them to perform at their best in those conditions, it doesn't make sense, especially when institutions are talking about how they're developing curriculums, how they're developing ways of learning. And I do not know how you can sort of marry together that idea of thinking about more collaborative learning styles and trying to innovate how you're teaching and the ways that you're teaching, and then saying, okay, but at the end of that, we're going to put a bunch of students in a lecture theatre, put them into, or in an exam hall rather, put them under time constraints and think that they're going to be able to perform their best. And, you know, it's even more difficult when you think about how how big the mental health crisis still is for students. You know, how do you justify wanting to say all of these things about bringing in student support, but then you're happy to put them under stress and put them in such conditions that is having a negative impact on their mental health? It just doesn't, it doesn't sit well together. It doesn't make sense.
I think you have to kind of I mean, I think that kind of comment, Jim, that you experienced is sort of axiomatic of the sorts of things that happen when time isn't taken to bring people together to really dive into to people's sort of preconceptions and prejudices and biases that they're bringing to this process. Because I don't think that person was wrong in the sense that, of course, if you're diving deep into a subject, if you're doing something that's unfamiliar, if you're, you know, trying to bring together kind of, you know, synthesize complex information, there's an element of stress in that. Of course there is. It's challenging. It's stretching. You know, you should be putting yourself under stress. But that's a kind of positive stress, the kind of stress that leads to learning and growth, not the sort of stress that leads you to have a kind of, you know, like sort of, you know, think that you need to kind of pop some pills and stay up all night and cram. And, you know, it's just, I think, particularly when you're thinking about students with particular kind of other sorts of pressures, you know, their lives are pretty stressful already in a number of ways, you know, lots of juggling home and work, perhaps caring responsibilities, perhaps, you know, coping with and managing their disability, what, you know, whatever it is. So sort of thinking really carefully about, yes, we want to stretch our students. Yes, we want to stress them. But how do we do that in a way that then generates learning outcomes? And that's a deep conversation, because of course we're not saying wrap students in cotton wool, protect them from stress, don't let these fragile flowers have to kind of deal with anything complicated or difficult. Of course we're saying it is complicated and difficult, so let's make it, so let's strip out the bits of it that are damaging and focus on the bits that are good.
When my mother was alive, she went to the doctors and she said, oh, I didn't trust him, he was looking on Google for the answers. And I was thinking, but I want my medics to have access, and it probably wasn't Google, but I want the medics, for example, to be able to do that in their everyday life. I want them to be able to not just sort of sit there and think, I wonder what's wrong with it. What did I learn 5 years ago at university? I want them to have access
What information am I going to manufacture to kind of, you know, present the facsimile of knowing, because that's what's going to build their confidence rather than kind of actually being we need to rethink the idea of professionalism in this space.
So authentic assessment is when somebody can use what they've learned in the way that they want to use it when they graduate. That's not sitting down for 3 hours in an exam hall.
Thing is, though, it's not scalable, is it? Anyway, no time for that debate. there's more on this on the site. Debbie's got a kind of thing of the stuff that we've been doing with Adobe. Well worth a look, and an article on the site from Monday that deep dives into some of these issues. So take a look.
Can I give a plug to my colleague Sarah Knight, who's doing a whole load of work on digital assessment as well, and that's going to be out this month.
Yes, you can. Now, last week, the Office for Students published almost final proposals for the Teaching Excellence Framework, building on the work. Remember that? Remember to building on the work of Dame Shirley Pearce, whose statutory review sparked a lot of the changes. Earlier this week, Debbie grabbed a cup of Java with Shirley P to find out more.
Shirley, hi, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for joining us. You blogged for us this week about the OFS proposals for the new version of TEF. And of course, as the chair of the independent review of the TEF way back in 2019, you must have been very pleased to see these proposals finally come to the table. What were you pleased to see about what OFS is suggesting should happen next?
Well, I mean, first of all, as you say, I'm really, really pleased to see it there at all, and to see that serious consideration has been given to the review findings and recommendations, as well as to the government's response, and that what we have is a really serious set of proposals for enabling TEF to re-emerge as something which really helps improve and enhance the excellence of provision across the sector. So I'm really pleased it's there, really pleased to read it. And probably most important is I'm really glad that the need to determine a really serious clarity of purpose has been taken on board, and that the idea that the TEF should have a primary purpose of enhancing provision has been bought by everybody, and that's the way it's being designed, because form follows function. Unless you're really clear about what it is you want an exercise to do and its impact, then you can't make the best informed decisions about how it should be designed and promoted. And to be clear that enhancing function, enhancing the quality of our educational provision is the core purpose, is a big step forward.
Mm. I had calls recently of, you know, looking at these proposals to go back over the original suggestions for the TEF, and there was so much more emphasis on using it to inform student choice and inform employers. But it seems that the overall intention does seem to have moved on a little bit. And I think that can only be to the good. But there's also, they also took your recommendation that there shouldn't be a subject level exercise. And, you know, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think we were clear that there were some big risks about the subject level exercise, which might undermine the credibility of the TEF exercise as a whole. We, however, were, and I think in every listening session and every part of the call for views, we heard people saying that the subject level information with the benchmarks and splits for subjects were really, really helpful inside institutions for helping identify pockets of excellence and pockets of not such good performance, and in sharing better practice across an institution internally and shining a light on what where attention needed to be directed. So we were really clear that a subject level exercise had value, but that a subject level rating might bring risks. And I think that's been taken on board. So that's another thing that I'm very happy about.
Mm-hmm. And I think sort of dovetails with the general direction of travel with OFS and looking at student outcomes by demographic, by subject split. Perhaps I think institutions may not feel entirely empowered when it comes to the volume of data they're going to have to wade through, but it is going to really kind of prompt some quite challenging questions, isn't it, at that more salami slice level of thinking about different student experience.
Yeah, and I think institutions that have been taking the student experience seriously for some time will already have some of that infrastructure in place and are already looking at that kind of data. And this will encourage all to do that in a more coordinated fashion.
Mm. And is there anything that you mentioned in your article? You said that there's a few potholes ahead. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, the big pothole that I see is the proposal for the bottom rating being needs improvement. We worked from the assumption that this is a measure of teaching excellence. This is an exercise to identify excellence, promote excellence, and share best practice. And it seemed really clear that to us that the gold, silver, and bronze ratings didn't do that as well as we might hope, and were misunderstood across the internationally. Plus, also, bronze was being seen not as a measure of excellence, but rather a measure of not doing very well. And that seemed wrong. These are all measures, levels of excellence. But the bottom level rating must be meets baseline requirements, or some sort of indication that it meets the requirements to be registered, but doesn't demonstrate marked excellence. To say it needs improvement seems problematic, because you aren't able to say what that improvement is. And it's not, I mean, I'm really pleased that attention has been given to the relationship between the TEF and the regulatory registration requirements of regulation, because we identified a sort of grey area at the bottom end of the TEF ratings. And so that's been identified and considered, but I don't think that the proposal for needs improvement actually addresses that. And I suspect that that's going to be what I've called in the article in my blog a pothole, because it's going to raise questions and problems which are going to be tricky for OFS to answer.
Brilliant. Shirley, thank you so much for joining us. Shirley's article features as part of a raft of content that we have on the site, looking at the OFS approach to B3 student outcomes and the Future Teaching Excellence Framework. So do check the show notes and go to the site to find out more.
Now, next up, new survey data from the Office for National Statistics this week gave us a little window on the experiences of students in their third year or beyond. Hilary, what did we learn?
There were a load of students, not unexpectedly, reporting poor mental health and well-being, and how that had worsened. And that was really interesting, given, you know, the discourse around support and how much students were needing extra support throughout the pandemic. And I think it's well worth saying third year students really felt the brunt of the pandemic, trying to finish largely their courses in a time where they were having poor working conditions in some case, no access to Wi-Fi or internet. and not having the same sort of support that they would be used to in their final year of university. So lots and lots of interesting things were drawn out in that. And I bet we've got lots to talk about in that.
Debbie, we all had a rough pandemic, didn't we? I mean, I've been stuck in this attic for 2 years. You know, what size violin should we get out for these students?
a pragmatic violin. I think that the question really is what is the impact going to be in the longer term? And, you know, we're all sort of dealing with that in our own ways. But when you're a student at a university, there, you know, in theory, you have a group of people around you and systems around you that are kind of designed to, you know, investigate and rectify if, you know, I guess there's a sort of moral question about what universities should do. I think, you know, there's a caveat to this data, isn't there? Because the response rates were not enormously high. So I think it's rather than rushing to sort of assume all third year students are in kind of mental health crisis, it's probably incumbent now to say this tells us that there might be a problem. Common sense also tells us there might be a problem here. We have, you know, we have in most cases 6 months, not, you know, probably, you know, rather less than that actually, to think about what is possible to put in place to perhaps mitigate some of those things. So first of all, to understand the problem as best we can in the time available, and then think about what mitigations might be. Jim, on the site, you've put a strongly worded suggestion that you know, we need to look at assessment again and think about whether there's kind of space for mitigation. I suspect some of this will be about students kind of articulating what they need to build their confidence as they go out into the labour market, to feel like their university experience wasn't a total waste of time. And I think it might be rather different for different students, and an assessment probably plays a part of that.
I mean, Laurie, I don't know. I mean, you know, there are a lot of the sort of comment pieces, aren't there, about, you know, the lost generation and, you know, lost youth and so on. But I mean, it does strike me that, you know, for students that are in their third year as undergraduates, that for the pandemic, this kind of much longer pandemic than any of us thought it was going to be, to kind of hit throughout that period must be pretty rotten in terms of that kind of, you know, that kind of romantic best years of your life stuff, but also the actual kind of teaching and learning experience.
So I think during the pandemic, it's been pretty grim for students, and, you know, the figures tell us that. It's not been easy for staff. And again, I'm being pragmatic. But when we look around the sector, I think what it's done is shown us just how hard lecturers are working to give a decent experience. And it is a lost generation. It's not a lost generation. I think saying that is a bit disingenuous, because what we've found is students connecting in different ways. We found students finding new ways to engage with their peers and finding new skills in terms of how they learn. And lecturers have been finding new ways to teach. And I think there's an awful lot of learning coming out of it. I want us to sort of move forward positively. I don't want to reset the clock, and we certainly can't go back in time. So I don't like the rhetoric of a lost generation. I'd rather think of us as, you know what, we've learnt an awful lot. And yes, it's been bad for some people, but, you know, now we've got to move forward with some really positive takes on this. Some things we've got to ditch. You know, I'd like to see us rethink assessment completely. That's a top line for me. You know, take that stress out of learning and teaching. But I'm trying to find the positive in the pandemic, and that's very hard, but I think that there are some.
And Hilary, I mean, look, you know, I mean, I think, you know, what Laurie says makes sense, you know, kind of focus on the positive and so on. But there is a danger, isn't there, in higher education, that because those of us that are in it are kind of operating a conveyor belt, that it's really easy to look at new students, first year students, and to focus on them and making their experience good. And then to almost kind of subconsciously write off this kind of this particular group that this survey was fashioned around.
Yeah, I think there's something really important about understanding the cumulative sort of like the cumulative impact of what students experience year on year on year. And that's been sort of one of our key criticisms coming around the NSS, that, you know, when you think about students' experience, I think sometimes because of the recruitment practices and then because of the graduate outcomes, that first and final year is sort of highlighted or heralded as these sort of areas where lots of effort is put in to try and get the best sort of, you know, look at the university, best sort of look at the students. But actually, those years in the middle where lots of stuff happens to students is a really important part to understand how students come in, what they experience, and what that means for when they finish their degree and finish their time at university if they choose to. And I think there's something really important about making sure that we understand the level of support that is needed throughout to ensure that we are keeping in touch with what these students need and how they need to be supported as they go on throughout their educational experience. And so I know that there's lots to try and find, you know, positive aspects of this, but I think, you know, this isn't just a pandemic thing. For a very long time, we've needed to understand that cumulative impact. And I don't think we've gone deep into it enough at all. And I think that is largely due to, you know, a larger focus that we're seeing at the OFS, particularly around outcomes and that continued sort of drive and push towards student recruitment and what it looks like to get students in, get them in sort of on this high, and then sort of think that you can now leave them to go on with the university experience untouched by all of the things that come in between that then add up when you're finishing your degree or your course or your educational experience.
Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? Here to set this week's correlation question is Wonky's Associate Editor, David Kernahan.
Welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? The podcast segment that was ambushed by a cake and lived to tell the tale. With all the end of cycle excitement, this week's correlation question is a UCAS special. In the 2021 cycle, does the number of UK main scheme applications at a provider have any relation to the number of those applications a provider accepts? Do providers with a larger intake get more applications? Or is something else going on? Yes, but does it correlate?
I'm happy to say I don't think there is a strong positive relationship. Because I was looking at some of the things that were on David's data sheet today and sort of trying to make sense of it. And I was like, I don't think that's as strong as people make out.
I don't know. I would think that it has some weight to it. I think especially when you're thinking about institutions that are particularly worried about not getting as many students in, there might be something around, you know, if you see an influx of applications in a certain course area that you don't feel has enough students, maybe there's a correlation, but I don't know enough about how they might weigh that out as opposed to thinking about what they're going to do with that course going forward. But I think there's moderate weight to it, I think, yeah.
And as you'll be able to see from the chart on the podcast page of the website, there is indeed a very strong correlation. R squared is a spectacular 0.96. Of course, this doesn't mean that there is a direct one-to-one relationship. I've included an X equals Y line to show that most places get many, many, many more applications than they offer places to. The most popular providers to apply to and to be placed at are both in Manchester, the University of Manchester and Manchester Metropolitan University. Data is from the 2021 UCAS end of cycle data, and the plot omits the numerous small providers that are not registered with the UK Higher Education Regulator. And where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
Now, finally, a new report from the QAA finds a sector split on the impact of digital provision on students. Hilary, tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is particularly interesting given the ongoing discourse around what the future of teaching and learning looks like and student engagement on a wider level. We know from the pandemic that digital provision came in a really emergency remote way. I heard that terminology at a conference that I attended a while ago, and I thought that really captured what the pandemic looked like in terms of the digital provision. It was emergency remote learning. But now that we are starting to sort of adjust to it and understand the benefits and maybe the drawbacks of it, it was really interesting that in this report, there was quite an interesting split between how people were feeling about digital provision. One of the stats that really caught me was the 41% felt that asynchronous learning increased student engagement, and 43% felt it lowered student engagement. And I thought that was an unsurprising but an interesting split, and perhaps it suggests something about accessibility but not engaging. And there's lots to think about actually as we go towards thinking about how do we do digital provision right, and how do we do it in a way that actually continues to serve what many people are currently arguing about, what could be perceived as quality when it comes to digital teaching, learning, and general student engagement.
Laurie, let me ask you this question, right? So, I mean, I think most people accept that, you know, computers exist and, you know, there's a bit of blended, there was plenty of blended learning going on before the pandemic, right? People were watching videos on the bus and all that sort of stuff. But when it comes to this question about synchronous versus asynchronous, if there's a whole bunch of people who really, really want kind of synchronous to be kind of in the room or in the space at the same time as others, and that works for them, and then there's a bunch of other people who really, really need kind of asynchronous, they kind of like the pace of that and so on, are they actually compatible? Can we wedge those students together and just offer a blend, or do we have to have a kind of new split? The old split was in person or distance. Maybe the new split has to be kind of synchronous students and asynchronous students, doesn't it?
Well, that works. We can do that. It's the thing. This is the thing that that I get really vexed with some of the commentary on what's been going on, is this idea of in person and distance, or, you know, asynchronous. How is this what we're doing now not in person? You know, and that I know what people will say, but, you know, I feel that I'm having a chat. I've never met anybody on this call, but we're having a chat, we've been laughing, and I feel present. So we can do that, and we can be synchronous without being in the same room. And this recording is going to be going out, and I'm hoping that, you know, at least one or two people might enjoy some of it. And that's going to be asynchronous. And the experience won't be the same, but you'll still get the same content out, I think. So it's a really difficult situation to sort of say you have to go one way or the other. And I think that a lot of people would like us to see it in opposition, but it's not. It's a continuum, and it's been a continuum. You know, when I went to university, I was a mature student, and, you know, I was really excited to do some of this work on a computer, you know, that I had to go in and use, and there were some things that were written in bespoke computer programs, and I went and looked at them, and it was great. And I thought, this is the future, and it's been the future for 25 years. People will enjoy it, people won't, but let's not set them up in opposition.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Hilary, Laurie, Debbie, DK, everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky. We'll be right back.